Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Now, in Baghdad today, a new wave of violence, more than 40 people killed in car bomb attacks. This as the Washington Post reports that more than 1,300 Iraqis have been killed following last Wednesday's bombing of the mosque in Samarra. And also today, news that a majority of American troops in Iraq want to come home. A new poll released by Zoghbi International asked U.S. troops about their feelings about the war. It is the first poll of U.S. troops currently serving in Iraq. And joining us to talk more about it is John Zoghbi, President of Zoghbi International. John, first tell us, how many troops, meaning individual servicemen and women, did you talk to?
944 United States military.
How did you conduct the survey?
There were four distinct locations that were selected where there were clusters of troops on the ground. We received verbal permission from commanding officials on the ground, though no real official word from permission from the Department of Defense.
And how did you ask them about troop duration? How did you ask them about how long they think they should be in Iraq?
Well, that was somewhere in the middle of the survey. There were preliminary questions about the mission, but when that question came up, we asked how long should American troops stay in Iraq, and the options were anywhere from leaving immediately and leaving within 6 months to a year, all the way up to staying the course until the job is completed.
Which is what President Bush, of course, has called for.
That's right.
What was the response?
72%, when all added up, said that troops should leave within the next 12 months. 23% said that we should stay the course, and that included a greater preponderance of full-time people, military people in the Army and in the Marines, as opposed to National Guard and reservists who were much more anxious to get home.
We understand that 29% of the service people you questioned said that the U.S. should leave immediately.
That's correct. One in three. And again, among those who said that they wanted to leave immediately, you had a tilt towards the National Guard and the reservists who felt that way more strongly, say, than the Army and Marines.
Well, John Zoghbi, you also asked about the service people's understanding of the U.S. mission in Iraq. What did they say?
Well, that was right up front, one of the very early questions. And basically, you had a substantial number of people, 58%, who said that the mission was clear. But the remainder, all 42% remaining, said that they weren't clear in what the mission was about anyway. And that's a substantial number.
Well, we understand that 90% of the respondents think that the war in Iraq is in retaliation for Saddam Hussein's role in 9/11. And as we know, there have just been no facts connecting Saddam Hussein to 9/11.
Right. And just so that your listeners understand, the initial question we asked was, do you understand the mission, how clear it is? And then what we did was we offered specific factors that have been listed as possible missions. That was one of them, and that actually came in number one, as the number one reason for the mission, that removing Saddam Hussein, and then way down in the list, spreading or expanding democracy or making the lives of the Iraqi people better.
There was an interesting conflict, it would seem, in one of the responses. 72% of the respondents said that U.S. troops should pull out within the year. You also asked how the troops view Americans back home who are calling for rapid troop withdrawal from Iraq. And what did they say about those Americans?
A majority said that they thought that those people were unpatriotic, which is very, very interesting and very nuanced. So on one hand, these were troops who were saying, we're ready to come home. We're not sure what the mission is, and we're not sure what we're doing. On the other hand, minding very much the lack of support.
John Zoghbi, this is the first poll of U.S. servicemen and women in the field. Did the military agree to help you do it?
We received verbal permission by commanding officials on the ground. We did not receive, nor did we request, any official sanction from the Department of Defense.
John Zoghbi of Zoghbi International on the first poll of U.S. servicemen and women in Iraq. John, thanks very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you. And now a check-in on Fat Tuesday, which literally means Mardi Gras. For longtime residents of New Orleans, this day has always been more than a party, and that's never been more true than this year. Four distinct types of organizations are behind the week of carnival leading to today. Some cost thousands of dollars to join. There are the social aid and pleasure clubs, the ball-only organizations, which only hold formal affairs, the Mardi Gras Indians, and the Crews, K-R-E-W-E-S. Well, the Zulu Crew is an African-American group that started in 1909 after they weren't allowed to participate in the all-white crews, such as Rex. Now the Zulu Parade is one of the most popular. The Zulus usually appear in blackface and grass skirts. And this year they're wearing tuxes because their costumes were destroyed by Katrina. We spoke earlier with Larry Hammond. He's one of two Zulu kings this year, and we asked him, why two kings?
As a result of the hurricane, our organization wasn't able to have the traditional carnival ceremony where we crown our king for the next year due to the loss of a lot of home ownership and financial structure caused us to not have all of the ceremonies.
Right.
So this year what we're going to do is everyone will be in tuxedos, and he will serve as the king for this year because the crown has not been transferred.
Well, you know, Larry, that points out that there is strict ritual to this. The fact that he didn't physically get to do that, transfer his crown at a coronation, means that you both have to be on a float.
That is correct.
What are the biggest responsibilities of a Zulu king?
The Zulu organization, I need to start with by saying that we're more than just an organization for Mardi Gras. We started off basically in 1909 as a benevolent organization where we would bury our members. We are an organization that participate in many other social activities and feed the homeless. We have a Christmas basket program, a Thanksgiving basket program, a mentoring program. Those are some of the things that the king, as well as the organization, gets involved with throughout the year. We're not just Mardi Gras parade, end of story.
I should say, Larry, we're talking to you on your cell phone as you get ready for this, you know, this big day, and sometimes the sound has been fluctuating, but we hear you loud and clear that this is a big deal with a big history, and we understand that Zulus apparently have the most prized throw on the parade route. Some throw beads, but no, your group throws painted coconuts.
That is correct.
What's the symbolism?
We did not have money to buy beads, and the coconut was a very inexpensive product that was used. We had brothers back in the early days that worked on the vegetable trucks, and they had farmers markets and so forth, and they used that coconut as a very inexpensive means of a Mardi Gras favor. The blackface evolved as a result of not being able to afford a mask. The plastic mask back then, I understand, was 10 cents, but what the membership did was got soot out of a chimney and used it as the blackface, and they used Lord, white Lord, as the circle around the eyes and the mouth. A Lord can was used to symbolize the crown. It was all because we did not have the funds to put on the things that Rex and the other carnival organization had.
Those are the white organizations. Yeah, those are the white
organizations. Uh-huh. That's correct. And so from that evolved the grass skirt, which was mosque, M-O-S-S, off of trees, as well as black leotards. And it was all designed to mock Rex.
That's Larry Hammond. He's one of two Zulu kings in this year's Mardi Gras parade. And again, Rex, a white crew. But we want to note, many New Orleans say they're comfortable with the segregated crews. Others have tried to crack the whites-only crews in recent years to great controversy. But everyone accepts that the Mardi Gras Indian tribes are an African-American phenomenon. They were started when Indians sheltered runaway slaves. These groups lead a second line of tambourine-shaking singers from the city's black neighborhoods early in the morning on Fat Tuesday. Linda Green is queen of the Seminole tribe, and we asked her to clarify. She calls herself Seminole, but she's actually African-American.
Okay, I am an African-American. We're honoring the American Indian, Seminole Indian. This is our tribe, but we are Black American.
Right. Do you also call yourself an Indian, sort of in, comradeship with the Indians?
Correct. Actually, the chief of the Seminoles originally, the real Seminoles, the chief of the Seminoles represented peace. The Seminoles also represent a culture that will not die out, just like the African-American culture.
This year, you won't all be in costume. What happened to your costumes?
Well, we lost our costumes in the flood, Katrina. Katrina, like we stayed in St. Bernard Parish, and the water level went up to the roof.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone lost everything. We lost everything. So the only thing we could do, we came up with, is if everybody just combined their knowledge and help and put the big chief on the street at least. And his costume this year represents survival. He's wearing red. Red is for the victims that were lost in Katrina.
Yeah. Well, what else do you plan to do during the parade route? First of all, where are you going to be?
Usually the Seminoles leave out of the Night Ward, and there's a track they run down St. Claude, up St. Bernard, down Claiborne, and eventually all of the Indian tribes meet at Shakespeare Park uptown. This year what they're doing is they're meeting at the barge in the Night Ward, where the barge came through the Night Ward and flooded the Night Ward.
Oh, this is the barge we've seen pictures of. It. It's a huge barge that came through the levee, and it's sort of sitting on the land.
Right. So this is where we're starting at this year.
I just find it interesting that African Americans are taking up the causes of Indian tribes, because many African Americans don't know their heritage or where they came from.
Right. Because we have so much in common. There's so much similarity that happened with the Indian and with the African.
It's fascinating, Linda. I understand the big chief is there with you. Can we speak to Keith Jones?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello.
Hello, Big Chief.
How you doing, ma'am?
I'm fine. I know your name is Keith Jones. What are you called during Mardi Gras?
Big Chief Quito.
Quito. Well, what does that mean to be the Big Chief?
I feel like I can bring something back to the city, you know, that Katrina took away from all my people. And I just so happen to have some stuff left that I was able to hook up and just bring something back. So I'm going to be all in red. The red represents my blood for all the victims that was lost in Hurricane Katrina.
What does that mean to you when you've got that costume on?
Oh, I feel like a king. It's just a great feeling, you know, and I've been doing this for years. You know, I come up like 14 years old doing this, you know, now I'm 46, so I've been doing this for years. So it's a great feeling, and I know that's what that feeling is like, you know. You just get this other feeling, like, you know, the spirit just come in you, you know, you just feel so good. It's like you're in control.
And boy, Keith Jones, I'm thinking after what you guys have been through, feeling a little bit of in control is probably a really good thing.
Katrina was catastrophic, and you know, you can't stop Mother Nature. You can't stop a storm. We already understand that a storm is what it is, you know, but I'm coming back to show that Katrina couldn't stop me.
Keith Jones, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And say thank you to Linda as well.
I appreciate it too, ma'am. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
The Seminole King. We also spoke to the Seminole Queen. And later in the program, we're going to hear more about the Mardi Gras Indians and hear the music handed down over generations of African Americans. But up next, a very important Supreme Court decision. That's coming up next. Much more coming up over the program. Stay with us here and now. There's been a major setback to abortion clinics from the Supreme Court today. In an 8-0 decision, the court ruled that federal extortion and racketeering laws cannot be used to ban demonstrations outside of abortion clinics. For more on that decision, we're going to turn to Jonathan Turley, a law professor at George Washington University. Welcome, Jonathan.
Well, thanks.
And what does this mean for abortion clinics? What can or can't they do?
Well, abortion clinics still have protection under the 1994 law called the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act. And what that law created was some parameters, some distance that protesters have to stay from these clinics. But it still allows protests to occur. And frankly, I think what happened in this case was some pretty serious overreaching by the National Organization for Women. You know, this has been a very unsuccessful 2 decades in terms of this line of cases. Now kept on trying to use what was a novel sort of weapon against the abortion protesters. They argued that they could proceed against them as sort of racketeers, using the Hobbs Act, which really deals with extortion. And that act gave them the ability to seek very significant damages against these protesters. But, you know, it was in some ways it was too creative by half. You know, mm-hmm. What ended up happening is that a lot of public interest groups opposed now and said, what you're doing is threatening free speech, that if you can do this against anti-abortion protesters, then anyone could really do this.
Right. Compare protesters to extortionists and use the law to ban them from standing outside of anywhere.
Yeah, and, you know, the interesting thing is that now, to Now's credit, they were getting successful rulings from the Seventh Circuit. But, you know, the Supreme Court has really handed them a series of defeats on this one. And so what the court is saying is that, you know, there is a natural tension often between interests like the need for access to a clinic and free speech. But that they believed that the Congress had already protected the clinics and given them some parameters to make sure access remained open, and that what now was trying to do was a serious threat to First Amendment rights.
Well, Jonathan, what do we make of this ruling? Would you say it reflects the new court? And I'm guessing the answer might be no, given that we read that Justice Alito didn't participate in this decision.
That's right. And also, this is an 8-0 decision. And so now has succeeded in accomplishing the impossible. They united the court. And, you know, both liberals and conservatives on the court viewed Now's argument as really beyond the pale, that it was too much of a threat to the First Amendment.
Of course, the difference between the abortion clinics and other groups that might be protesting this kind of legislation is that people have been killed at abortion clinics. You know, is there any sense that the judges weighed that sense of violence and danger that might happen?
You know, frankly, I don't believe that they did do that. They did take note of the fact that there's already a federal law guaranteeing access. And I don't think that any of the judges or justices now that have ruled on this belittled the importance of the interest for Now and women trying to get access. I mean, the record in this case shows some really appalling conduct in statements made by abortion protesters. And I don't think anyone's minimizing that. But the problem is that, you know, the First Amendment doesn't distinguish between obnoxious speech and you know, non-obnoxious speech.
Well, Jonathan, we want to make sure we ask you, if you think this case shows us anything about how the new court might rule on pending abortion-related cases.
I don't think it does, but I do think that in this term and next term, we're looking at some very serious abortion cases that will tell us a lot, including, as you know, one case that is on the docket, but also we've got the South Dakota case, which is very likely to bubble its way up to the Supreme Court. That's a dead-on attack on Roe. It's a law designed to see if there's now five justices that will say Roe is badly decided and be done with it.
Okay, well, speaking of bubbling up to the Supreme Court, Anna Nicole Smith, who was then the 26-year-old topless dancer in Texas who married the 89-year-old billionaire and is now at the court in this sort of legal soap opera, you know, suing for a half of the inheritance from this gentleman who died shortly after marrying her. The son, his son, is saying that he should get most of the money. Has she appeared before the court yet, and what's happened there?
Well, she has appeared, and many people view that as a sign of the apocalypse. But she's in the courtroom. And, you know, the great irony about this case is that behind the remarkably sordid record in which both Anna Nicole Smith and the son, Prentice Marshall, both come off as just really terrible people, there is a serious issue of law here. I mean, Anna Nicole Smith, whether you like it or not, could become sort of the Miranda of probate law. I mean, this is a case that will determine what courts should decide contested wills. And it's going to be Anna Nicole Smith that's going to be the case that people cite.
Jonathan Turley, a law professor at George Washington University. We kind of want to have that happen, you know, just to hear people say that when they refer to the law in the future. Jonathan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Great pleasure. Thanks.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line, leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name. Tell us the town you're from. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WB. Several board members of the group Catholic Charities here in Boston are protesting the church's attempts to exclude gay couples from adoptions. The state's Catholic bishops are trying to get an exemption to anti-discrimination laws, but Governor Mitt Romney has said he would not grant the church an exception. Catholic Charities, a national organization with local chapters, has acknowledged placing children with gay couples in the past here in Boston, and that's caused a serious breach between the lay board and the archdiocese, and that may have ramifications for the national debate over gay adoptions. We should add here that Paul DeCamera, the general manager of WBUR, our home public radio station here in Boston, is a member of the local Catholic Charities Board. David O'Brien is professor of Roman Catholic Studies at the College of the Holy Cross, and he joins us from the campus in Worcester, Massachusetts. Professor, welcome.
Hello.
And can you give us some context here? First of all, Catholic Charities, a national organization, but who sets the rules and do they differ state to state?
Well, they do differ state to state. Each one is set up under the laws of the given states, but people will be surprised, I'm sure, with all our discussion in recent years about faith-based organizations to realize that for almost a century now, we've had a whole lot of ways in which state and local governments and even the federal government have worked with private charities, including those under religious sponsorship, to deliver social services in ways that are beneficial to everybody concerned. And those kinds of partnerships between private and public agencies are really quite common in medical care, social service, and indeed in higher education where I work.
And we understand that Catholic Charities is, in fact, the largest social service agency in the country.
It is. And one of the things we have to be concerned about in this kind of controversy is that damage will be done to Catholic Charities, both in terms of public support in the Catholic public, but also in terms of bringing some of the complexities of the legal relationships between state and local and federal governments and these private agencies into the courts for endless adjudication. We've been able to do a lot of this work effectively to deliver needed social services through private auspices because we've been flexible and been willing to compromise and been willing to negotiate and live with a good deal of complexity that arises from our religious pluralism.
You're speaking of the relationship with the states.
Sure.
But is Catholic Charities supposed to be independent of the church?
Well, it is. It's separately incorporated ordinarily, and it has its own board of directors, and it's accountable under the laws that govern nonprofit charitable agencies. So that's right. It has a high degree of independence. Now, if you follow the news on things around Catholic Charities, you'll notice that the independence sometimes does seem to be compromised. That is to say that the bishop may seek to impose on Catholic Charities or on Catholic hospitals or Catholic universities a rule arising from church life that may be resisted by an autonomously incorporated body like Catholic Charities. So there's necessarily some tension, of course. The bishop is the head of the diocese, and Catholic Charities has its own board. The bishop is involved in that board, and sometimes what the church requires and what the Catholic Charities organization requires may come into tension and conflict.
Well, the Catholic bishops here in Massachusetts, again, as we said, are pressing the state to exempt the church from anti-discrimination laws so that they can ask Catholic Charities to ban gay couples from adopting. But does that request come from the Vatican to the bishops here in Massachusetts?
Well, there is some evidence that there was intervention by the Vatican. There was a news report that there was a letter that from the nuncio to the archbishop asking questions about what was going on in Massachusetts. So it does seem though there was some intervention. The Vatican has intervened on questions related to homosexuality kind of consistently now for almost two decades, intervened in dioceses where bishops were carrying on dialogue with a homosexual group called Dignity, Catholic Homosexuals, ordering them no longer to do so and not allow them to meet on church property. And then we had a whole series of statements from the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith prescribing not just ways in which there should be pastoral care with homosexuals, but even prescribing ways in which Catholic bishops and Catholic politicians should deal with questions of gay rights. And legislative proposals regarding homosexuality. So Rome has taken an active role in intervening on this issue right down to the eve of the 2004 election campaign, when strong statements came on the responsibilities of politicians to accord with church teaching.
Is this debate over gay adoption going on in other Catholic Charities groups in other parts of the country? And we should say, we know that other states have different kinds of laws regarding gay adoption. Florida, for instance, bans gay adoption.
There are conservative, I don't know that's the right word, but Catholic activist groups who are agitating these questions and are claiming that Catholic Charities organizations are not in accord with church teaching. They're writing letters to Rome. They're getting the congregations in Rome and the nuncio to be writing back to their bishops. So a lot of this is not happening just because of as if the Vatican is sitting there worrying about church teaching. There's a lot of Catholic Church politics going on, and there are some very active, very vigorous, very well-organized conservative groups in the church who feel that the integrity of the church is at stake in questions around homosexuality and a few other what they would regard as non-negotiable issues. So there are church politics involved as well. As we well know in Boston, if you followed the Catholic Charities dinner here in December, when there was a lot of agitation that led to the archbishops not coming to the dinner because an award was to be given to Mayor Menino. That didn't just happen out of nowhere. It happened because there were people actively at work trying to bring about that kind of confrontation.
That's because the mayor here in Boston supports choice in abortion. Well, you say that this is Catholic politics, and we should rush to say that there are some people who feel very strongly that this is a spiritual issue, and they feel very strongly that gay couples should not be allowed to adopt. On the other side, many members of the board of Catholic Charities point out that the sexuality of a couple doesn't matter. They need to find parents for these kids. Gay couples often take children others won't take.
Sure. We face a complicated situation in Massachusetts with the new law regarding gay marriage, and we know that. But there's one of the striking things here is the lack of trust that the leadership of the church is showing in its lay leadership, the board of directors, and in its professional leadership, the people in Catholic Charities.
Well, what do
Nobody
you think?
Who knows anything about Catholic Charities would think that they're allowing children to go into irresponsible situations or not monitoring these situations very, very carefully. And it's the lack of trust and the willingness to jeopardize, really, Catholic Charities and its strength and vigor for the sake of a kind of symbolic question of adoptions. Nobody believes that Catholic Charities involved in irresponsible adoptions at all.
Well, Professor O'Brien, given your opinion on that, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I'm heartened by the fact that a body of Catholic lay leaders have actually stood up and expressed what they think should be done, and they're not afraid to engage in some controversy and some effort to dialogue with the bishops about these questions. We've had a scandal in Boston now for 4 years, and very limited efforts of Voice of the Faithful, a few other efforts, but basically people have not been willing to kind of organize and step forward and confront these very conservative groups in the church that are agitating these questions. All of us believe that it's very important to have a church that's capable of assisting all of us to deal with the great moral questions that we have in public policy, from war down to adoptions. And it's not a good thing when that voice is just uttered from on high with no consultation with its people or with its pastors. The bishop doesn't just speak for Rome. He speaks for the local church, and that's all of us. And it's unfortunate that they don't consult the local church and listen before making these proclamations.
David O'Brien, professor at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. Professor O'Brien, thanks as always for being with us.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now. The Senate Judiciary Committee today held its second day of hearings on the National Security Agency's warrantless domestic wiretapping program. Today, scholars weighed in on the legality of the program and whether it is, as the Bush administration has said, a legal extension of the 30-year-old Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA. Here's Attorney Bruce Fine.
The theory invoked by the president to justify eavesdropping by the NSA in contradiction to FISA would equally justify mail openings, burglaries, torture, or internment camps, all in the name of gathering foreign intelligence.
Peter Greer is covering the hearings for the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us now. And Peter, we heard arguments this morning in favor and against the president's surveillance program. Did we hear anything new?
Well, I'm not sure we heard anything specifically new, but I took away two important points from the hearing.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is that there is widespread desire within the Senate, specifically and within the Congress in general, to have some kind of legislation in this area and try and bring the program under some sort of congressional control. And the second point I really took away from that is the reason for that is because there is a certain, I wouldn't call it a bipartisan reaction against it, but when you're dealing with issues of balance of power, the kind of things we've argued about since legislators wore wigs and breeches, you will get a line of debate between the Congress and the executive branch that really doesn't have that much to do with party all the time.
Well, and one question that was raised repeatedly was about the scope of the program. Here's Senator Russell Feingold.
I'm very concerned that the administration's theory in support of the NSA program has no limits and that it could be used to justify virtually any action and override virtually any statute based just on a tangential relation to combating terrorism. I don't know what would prevent the administration from authorizing all kinds of activities.
Oh, Peter, you said that this was a somewhat, bipartisan concern. Did any of the senators seem sympathetic to the administration position?
Well, I think some of the senators are sympathetic to the administration position. I'm not going to be able to go down line by line and say which everyone believes on in every particular point or how they would vote. But as I said, I think that that clip you just had from Senator Feingold does express the concern of a lot of people in Congress and certainly of a lot of legal scholars, which is that if you take the administration's arguments to their logical extreme in terms of war powers and war-making powers, they could pretty much do anything. And one legal scholar said that this could be just a loaded gun lying around for some future president to use.
Well, several of the lawyers, we understand, argued about the concept of the battlefield and whether it needs to apply to a literal battlefield, such as Afghanistan, or whether it can also apply to a figurative battlefield, such as the United States and the war on terrorism. Was there consensus on that?
Well, no, there wasn't. And, actually, I think that former CIA Director Jim Woolsey made a good point in that regard. He said, as many supporters of the administration's actions say, well, you guys are forgetting the nature of the struggle we're in. We're in an existential struggle against a fiercely committed foe. And Jim Woolsey said, well, remember, the United States is a battlefield. We have been invaded. We haven't been occupied, but there are invaders in our midst, and we have to try and find them.
Well, you mentioned that there were some other. Oh, I'm sorry. Continue. Did
oh
you?
No, and I just want. I don't want to say that Jim Woolsey didn't necessarily support some further action by the mm-hmm. Congress. I think he does, but I think that he is making an argument that many of the president's own supporters would make.
Well, you mentioned that people were trying to, propose ways to refine this, and Senator Arlen Specter is proposing something called the National Security Surveillance Act. It's intended to add oversight to the government's program, but there seemed to be a lukewarm response to that, and we're wondering, in about the minute we have, where do you think this whole issue goes from here, Peter?
Well, I think there has to be a political solution to it, an agreement between the administration and the Congress. I think that a legal solution working its way through the courts would be both unsatisfactory and wouldn't come for many years. I think Specter's bill will probably be refined to take out some of its glitches.
And we should note, too, that in another arena, the New York Times is suing the Pentagon for information about how the NSA program worked. And according to reports, they haven't heard back from the Pentagon on that. So this might yet end up in the courts. Peter Greer of the Christian Science Monitor, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Certainly, anytime.
And stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. It's Fat Tuesday, Mardi Gras, and today in New Orleans, parade floats, tourists, and discarded plastic beads line the major avenues. But what most tourists won't see began early this morning on the streets of Black Pearl, Treme, and the Lower Ninth Ward, some of the neighborhoods hardest hit by Hurricane Katrina. These are the parade grounds of the Mardi Gras, or Black Indians of New Orleans, the Golden Eagles, Creole Wild West, Wild Magnolias, the Fayayay. Altogether, about 40 tribes of African Americans dressed up or masked as Indians in elaborate sequined costumes. They take to the streets to unveil their new suit and sing about their great feats on Carnival Day.
I make Chalawan on my grand day.
Locals say that Indians once harbored escaped slaves in the swamps and that the slaves assimilated. And then in the late 19th century, blacks excluded from white carnival celebrations staged their own parades, dressing up in homage to the Native Americans they admired. Rituals and songs about warriors have been handed down through the generations. And while only half of the tribes are taking part in carnival this year and most of their costumes have been destroyed, a few have made recordings of this unique New Orleans sound. And here now's Virginia Prescott digs through the stacks. Mardi Gras begins early on the stoops of the Crescent City with a traditional chant, this one by Big Chief Jolly of the Wild Chapatulis from 1976, one of few releases by Black Indian groups.
Mardi Curifayo,
there's no clear-cut explanation for how Native American rituals and imagery became fused with African rhythmic chants. Willie Clark, editor of MardiGrasDigest.com, says that Indians and slaves were in contact at the port of Nouvelle Orleans since the early 18th century.
We first saw evidence of slaves dressing as Indians after the Natchez Revolt of 1729. The Indians and the slaves actually came together to prevent the sacred lands from being seized. That forged friendship between the two, and they were dressing as Indians, trying to adopt their ways.
Others say the traveling Wild Bill Hickok shows of the 1870s captivated blacks, who recalled the costumes of West Africa. Through the years, these pseudo-tribes paraded through black neighborhoods, staging mock battles and singing chants about their valor and beautiful costumes in a language all their own. That's the unmistakable Aaron Neville. Like many locals, the Neville brothers learned the chants during neighborhood Indian practices. The Nevilles laid those chants over New Orleans' signature funk on records with the Wild Magnolias and the Wild Chapatulis in the 1970s.
It's actually tribal. It's almost like a ritual of manhood.
Donald Harrison Jr. learned the traditions from his late father, who was chief of the Guardians of the Flame. Now Donald Jr. heads his own tribe. He's a professor and jazz saxophonist.
There's a lot of singing and drumming, call and response chants. The whole point of the ritual is for the big chiefs to meet each other and that we will have a glorious outcome so you can sing about it the next year, how great you did.
The valor wasn't only for show. Tribes were once armed street gangs. Willie Clark says Mardi Gras was the day to settle old scores.
These battles between two tribes actually came down to hatchets, shotguns, pistols, knives. Mothers literally used to cry in the morning when their kids or their young men or their husbands would dress as Indians and head out with the tribes because they didn't know whether or not they were going to see their child for the rest of their life.
But Mardi Gras Indian customs and music eventually crossed over to friendlier territory. In 1965, the Dixie Cups had a top 40 hit with Iko Iko. During a break in the studio, one of the girls started singing an Indian chant her mother taught her. The producers hit the record switch.
My grandma and your grandma were sitting by the fire. My grandma told your grandma, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. You're talking about hit now, hit now, hit now. Iko Iko Ande, Giacomo Fino Anale, Giacomo Finale.
People outside the black Indian culture were hearing an Indian chant for the first time. The language is another mystery. There are street meanings, but no scholarly translation exists of the terms Hu Na Ne, Giacomo Fino Hando, or Coup de Fayo. They may be corrupted Yoruba, Choctaw, or French. Big Chief Victor Harris of the Fayayay Indian tribe.
Well, now most of that is French, and I know what they call them. That's a Creole and stuff. Really, I never have the knowledge of understanding those words, but The guy come in, he asked me, oh, won't you come sing that in English for me? So...
The Wild Magnolias broke through with an R&B chart hit called Honda Wanda in 1970. Legendary producer Wilson Turbinton, or Willie T, says it was the first time a Mardi Gras Indian tribe played with conventional instruments.
It was like finding your soulmates. The first time that we played together, man, some of that music, it was just, magic. I think it's the closest thing to expressing the spirit of what New Orleans flavor is really all about. Doesn't have any one flavor.
The Mardi Gras Indian canon gets fatter every Fat Tuesday. A few of the Young Turk brass bands have recorded with Indian tribes, and in 1991, Dr. John and Donald Harrison Jr. collaborated here on the CD Indian Blues. This year, Black Indian songs will echo through the devastated neighborhoods of New Orleans.
There's no one in those neighborhoods because all of the people from the community have evacuated, but the spirit will bring it back.
Like generations before him, Big Chief Victor Harris came out singing with the Fa Yai Yai early this morning.
I mean, just because there's no one living in the neighborhood doesn't mean there's no one there. If we have some people that died in that community that lived in those houses, we can waken the spirits and let them know the spirit is still alive.
Big gang standing on the Magnolia Bridge. Early Mardi Gras morning. Yes, come a gang from the Metro Ridge. Struck without no warning. Talk about
here now, producer Virginia Prescott. Our thanks also to David Cunian in New Orleans. For more on the music and to see pictures of Mardi Gras Indians, visit here-now.org.
Early that morning on Mardi Gras Day, police blew his whistle. Yet come a chief from the other way with the big, long, shiny pistol.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our best to everyone in New Orleans today. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next.